Okay, this is Dr. Braun doing the liver lectures. We're going to have just a couple. In the past, we've had a little more time, as you know, for the GI unit, and just didn't work this year, evidently. So this is how I decided to do this one. And since it's starting into my allergy season, I'm snorting away. I'm in my office dictating this, so there's bound to be telephone calls, people yelling at me. My neighbor over there will probably start beating his head on the wall for some reason or other, so the Lord only knows all the kinds of distractions that will happen. At any rate, here we go with liver disease. Now, in the case of liver disease, really integral to what's going to happen or what's possible long-term outcomes will be the integrity of this lobule. Now, this is something that was talked about in the physiology unit because in order for the liver to do its job, it has this lobule and lobular arrangement has to be maintained. The blood has to have intimate association with the liver cells. Liver is a very complex gland, and it is the largest gland in our body. It's a derivative of the gastrointestinal epithelium embryonically. And this is really what defines how well the liver is going to work. Now, if this gets disrupted, or as a consequence of chronic inflammation becomes scarred, the liver is not going to be able to work as well as it should. And as we'll see, that'll have some very serious consequences for potentially many organ systems. So the maintenance of this lobular architecture is extremely important. The blood that we see here, the coloration in this depicts where we have arterial blood. Remember that the blood flow comes in these triads. The triads are out here at the corners of the lobule, and it's a mixture of both the portal venous blood, and you'll notice it isn't shown as being completely blue, even though it's venous blood. There's still a fair bit of oxygen in that venous blood that's coming in from the GI tract, and then that gets mixed with arterial blood from the hepatic arteries, and at each one of these triads, that same situation exists. And then the blood percolates through the sinuses and goes out the central vein and then into the inferior vena cava and back to the systemic circulation. You can see that with the zones here, you can see that there is a gradation, however, that most of the oxygenated blood is here. And by the time it percolates here into the central area, it's pretty well deprived of oxygen. So things that are toxic injuries to liver cells, such as alcohol and carbon tetrachloride and the like, will have the first effects and probably the most profound effects here in this central zone where we might expect oxidative damage or some kind of free radical injury because of lack of oxygen, relative lack of oxygen. So we want to understand the fact that the sinusoids here are very important because the blood is going to percolate very close to, have very intimate association with the individual liver cells. The triads conduct the bile away. Bile ducts are there. There's an arterial and venial. Now, this is a higher power view, and so what we're looking at here, let me go back for a minute. What we're going to look at right now will be a little section right in something like this with a triad here and looking at some of these liver cells in that immediate area. So here we have the triad. There is a hepatic venule right here. We don't see the arterial, but it's in here. Here are the bile ducts over here. This is so-called limiting plate. This is the first layer of liver cells. And this over here shows a vessel. This is one of the sinusoidal vessels. And you'll notice that there's a space in here. This is called the space of Disse, D-I-S-S-E. And that is a very important space because some of the plasma from the blood can seep into that space and then have very close association with the liver cells. I'm not saying blood, it isn't bleeding, it's just that this allows for fluid. These endothelial cells here that line the sinusoids have fenestrations, they have openings in them that allow some of the proteins and so forth to get out of the sinusoid and come in contact with the surface of the surface of the hepatocytes. And that allows for the picking up of bilirubin and so forth, the discharging of clotting proteins that the liver cells are making into the blood. And then as the blood percolates back towards the central vein, all that stuff gets recollected again into the flow of blood. So you have to have an extraordinary close association with these liver cells here. Now, we've already been through the business, I know, in the physiology segment with this, but we're going to just take a quick look at it. The idea of one of the important functions of the liver beyond producing albumin, producing clotting proteins and all kinds of things, is to neutralize toxins. And some of those toxins come from the GI tract. I mean, it's just part of our food and part of our environment. It gets picked up and absorbed and brought into the bloodstream, and the liver has to detoxify it. Other toxins are things that we make within us. And here's an example of one that would have very serious central nervous system effects if we didn't handle it properly. And that is the breakdown of the hemoglobin and myoglobin and cytochrome C, but getting that heme unit, the one that holds the iron in place, and breaking that down. And so when red cells are old and senescent and the liver tears them apart, the macrophages in the liver open up the liver cells, or open up the red blood cells rather, and remove the hemoglobin and break it down, they are going to metabolize the heme unit into the first stage of bilirubin, so-called biliverdin, and then that will be further metabolized and attached to an albumin. Now, bilirubin, the primary unconjugated bilirubin, as you I'm sure will recall, is very lipid soluble. It's not water soluble at all. So if it had a chance, it would collect in fat soluble air, fatty areas of our body, and our brain is one of the most that we have. All the lipids that are there associated with or part of the myelin and so forth, it would be sucked right into the brain effectively. So it has to stay stuck on the albumin. So albumin now serves as a transport protein for this highly toxic first stage of bilirubin, the breakdown stuff. And then as the blood flows through the liver then, and again the albumin and that close association, it leaves the vascular space and it gets into that space of Disse, it then has very close association to the hepatocytes. Hepatocytes pick up the bilirubin, they grab it from the albumin and they pull it into themselves, and then they metabolize it by adding basically carbohydrates to it to make it water soluble. And then it can be excreted in the bile, and it's fundamentally harmless, at least to our central nervous system. Some of that, since it's water soluble, does get kind of passively absorbed. It comes in here into the duodenum here, and it might well be that some of that bilirubin does get passively absorbed along with water, but it's not going to hurt us, and then it goes out in our urine. Most of it, however, goes right on out in the stool. So that's basically the excretion cycle. Well, this is a very important thing, that we are able to metabolize that bilirubin and get rid of it before it can get into the brain or into other lipid areas. So if it accumulates, of course, in the bloodstream because of defective liver, or even, say, extraordinarily rapid destruction of red blood cells, we can kind of overwhelm the liver's capacity to metabolize it. We will see consequences within the central nervous system, but also external consequences such as jaundice. Okay, so it's a good idea to review the physiology part of that and understand how that, what that metabolism is like and how that's working. Okay, let's take a look at some basic patterns here. We're going to develop several of these. And once again, I'll come back to this for just a moment, keeping in mind that that central zone of every lobule is relatively low in oxygen simply because of the way the blood percolates through it and goes out there. So if we see oxidative injury or toxic injury, it's going to be more pronounced in that central zone. I'll admit we don't really study that other than looking for it in certain forms of toxic injury. I'm going to talk about piecemeal necrosis in a few minutes when we start talking about cirrhosis. Now, what is it that causes liver injury? Well, every darn thing. You can have, we've talked about, if you think about major classes of injury or disease, the liver suffers from it just like every other organ. Can you have immunologic damage to the liver? Sure. Do some people make antibodies against liver cells or against the ductwork? Yes, they do. You can have infections of the liver. You can have ischemic injury with blood clots and so forth. You can have toxic injury, obviously, with alcohol and other sorts of things. Are there tumors or malignancies that arise in the liver? Yes, primary ones that arise in the liver. So every kind of injury that we have anywhere else in the body, every major classifier, also involves the liver. Now, one of the things about the liver, of course, is since it is involved in detoxifying so many things that are in the environment, and again, detoxifying stuff that we make, we will see that it's more subject to that kind of injury, toxic injury. Now, chronic ongoing injury, especially inflammatory changes, will lead to scarring and fibrosis within the liver, and may lead to an attempt to regenerate the liver. But the important factor is that we have to have that underlying architecture, that underlying lobular architecture has to come back, or this thing is not going to be functional. I'm going to back up here. We'll take a look at this. In other words, you see, if we were to take the liver itself, the entirety of the liver, and we could somehow wash out every liver cell, remove every liver cell, we would still have kind of a ghost-like or cobweb-like structure that looked like the liver, because there is connective tissue framework that the liver cells are plugged into. If we pulled them all out of there, we would still be able to see a lobular arrangement here made up of collagen and reticulin and things like that, that says this is what that liver architecture has to look like in order for everything to function as it should. Now, if you have chronic inflammation that destroys that underlying architecture, then when the liver cells try to regenerate, they don't know where they belong. The endothelial cells that line the sinusoids will proliferate, but they don't know exactly where they're supposed to go in relationship to the liver cells. The same goes for the ductal cells, the ductwork. So that underlying architecture is very important, and that is the connective tissue framework that represents the liver lobule. So when we say there's attempt at regeneration, that's very important, because some people have very successful regeneration after, say, a bout of hepatitis with viruses, whereas others do not. And it has to do with how much of that liver, that underlying framework, that connective tissue framework that says liver cells, you belong here, endothelial cells, you belong here, and duct cells, you belong over here. If that's destroyed, then they don't know how to reorganize themselves. Now, one of the things that we do know, we can see, if we do a biopsy on someone who has a sick liver, and sometimes we do, we will see accumulation of bilirubin within cells, such as is shown here, or sometimes in the ductwork. And that's helpful for us to determine whether we're looking at a problem of liver excretion, getting rid of bile, or whether there's a problem within the liver that says we can't metabolize the bilirubin. What we're looking at in this diagram right here would be essentially just a few liver cells. Here would be a sinusoid. Here would be the endothelial cells. This little space in here is that space I referred to as a space of Disay. Now, the sinusoids are also lined by macrophages. They're fixed macrophages. They don't move or get away. And they are picking up bacteria and stuff, just the way it works in your spleen. Surprising amount of basically lymphoid tissue, if you want to look at it like that. These so-called Kupffer cells, those are actually fixed macrophages. So we're just looking at a few of these. So that normal or healthy condition would be over here on this side of the liver. And here we see these little canaliculi. Now, if we have a problem with liver metabolism, let's suppose that liver cells are sick because of toxic injury from alcohol or maybe from a viral infection, and they can't actually do all their job, say, producing clotting proteins and detoxifying bilirubin, we'll see, say, bilirubin beginning to accumulate within the liver cell. And so if it accumulates within the liver cell, which is the number one here, by the way, then it says there's something wrong with the liver cell itself. It can't complete the job of detoxifying bilirubin. Well, a lot of other things it can't do too, but that's just the one that we can kind of measure. Let's suppose that there's a problem with an obstruction someplace in the ductwork. And let's suppose maybe there's a tumor compressing the ducts within the liver. And the liver cells themselves are actually capable of completing the breakdown of bilirubin, or at least the conjugation of bilirubin from unconjugated to conjugated bilirubin. and tries to excrete it, and it puts the bile into the canaliculi, but it cannot get out. It cannot move through the liver and continue the transit through the ductwork into the GI tract. Then we'll see the canaliculi kind of blow up like this. Well, if we see that, since there are really two different stages of detoxifying bilirubin, we actually can tell that from the species of bilirubin that accumulates in the bloodstream. If a person has a liver disease where the hepatocytes are sick, say in the case of viral hepatitis, bilirubin will go up and a person may become jaundiced, became yellow because bilirubin now is in the skin. But the species of bilirubin that would be elevated would be the unconjugated form. It would be the form that hasn't been through the liver because the liver simply can't do it. On the other hand, if someone had, say, a cancer of the pancreas and it compressed the biliary, the bile duct, so that you could not get bile out, well, the liver cells are still functioning all right. It's just that they can't get rid of the stuff. They put it into the ductwork and it can't go anywhere. In that case, we would see that they would be jaundiced, but in this case, the bilirubin that would be in the bloodstream in greater quantity would be the conjugated bilirubin. And that means it's been through the liver cell, it's been processed, but we're having trouble excreting it, getting rid of it. So just telling the difference in the laboratory between conjugated and unconjugated bilirubin will tell a doctor something as to whether the problem is with hepatocytes or the problem is one of excretion and getting actually rid of it. And there's, a plug in the duct, like a gallstone, for example. Okay, so if we're looking at intracellular problems, why it is the liver cell cannot function right, there are a variety of things. Sometimes medications do that, drugs do that, and by that I do actually mean medications, or alcohol, some toxic injury, viral infection. If you can't excrete, the liver cell cannot get completely rid of it, it gets it into the ductwork, but it doesn't get out of the liver, then there's some kind of obstructive process in the ducts. Again, drugs can do this because it will paralyze the ducts. The ducts have smooth muscle in it, and they massage and push the bile along. And if you have opiates, for example, that will paralyze those muscle cells, and then you don't excrete it. But physical obstructions, like a gallstone or a tumor, can also do that. Now, if we have advanced scarring within the liver, it's called cirrhosis. Cirrhosis is a combination of things that results from either chronic hepatitis, like a viral infection, chronic injury from alcohol, and so forth. And what occurs in that scenario is that we see kind of irreversible scarring of the liver, but most importantly, we have the disruption of the underlying architecture in the lobules, so that when regeneration occurs or tries to occur, you cannot get the lobule reconstructed as it's supposed to be. And again, I'm mentioning this now because this is a form of chronic injury that a lot of conditions can lead to. So we have chronic ongoing either inflammation or chronic ongoing toxic injury or something that leads to liver cell death and fibrosis within the liver and disruption of that underlying architecture. So when hepatocytes replicate in an effort to regenerate the liver, they cannot get themselves organized properly. And so the effect is that you don't have enough clotting proteins in the bloodstream. A number of things will happen. Let's take a look here at some of the events here. So what are some of the common features of cirrhosis? Again, we think about cirrhosis being related to alcohol use, but there are lots of reasons for it to develop a cirrhotic liver. Common features to all of them would be one, chronic inflammation leading to scarring and fibrosis. But the scarring and fibrosis is irreversible. You cannot undo it. If you've lost the underlying architecture for the lobules and the duct cells and the liver cells don't know where they belong in relationship to one another as regeneration occurs, you can never recreate that. So there's parenchymal loss, in other words, there's loss of actual functioning tissue. Very importantly, there's rearrangement of the blood vessels, and we'll look at that. We say altered vascularity here, but we're going to take a look at what it means to have the altered vascularity, and the blood cannot flow through the liver as it should. So there is an effort to regenerate. We wind up with these very peculiar nodules of liver cells and things, but they're not organized in a functional unit like we would see with the lobule. What are some of the symptoms? Well, this man is showing us a lot of the symptoms here. One will be accumulation of fluid in the abdomen, and the reason for that is the scarring in the liver prevents the blood flowing from the GI tract, the portal system, from coming through the liver. So the pressure backs up in the blood in the vascular system here, and the hydrostatic pressure literally exceeds the oncotic pressure of albumin and so forth in the blood, and then you have extravasation of fluid into the abdominal cavity, known as ascites. He's also showing gynecomastia, that is to say a female breast. This guy is developing breasts, and the reason for that is that the liver detoxifies or metabolizes estrogens that's present in everybody. Obviously, women have more. It's cyclic nature, but men have some, and it's balanced by our testosterone. If we have a liver that cannot metabolize, if the liver is sick and it cannot metabolize, it takes a long time, by the way, for this to happen, but as the estrogen levels build up in the bloodstream, man will start to develop breasts. That's called gynecomastia, female breast in a man. We'll see vascular dilatation. Here we see dilated blood vessels around the umbilicus and in the esophagus because, again, the back pressure in the venous system, since the liver is so scarred, blood cannot flow through it. It's kind of like a traffic jam. And all of the blood is trying to find some way back into the vena cava. The normal pathway is from the GI tract, is through the portal veins, through the liver, and into the inferior vena cava. If half of the streets are closed up or lost in the liver, half of those vessels are gone, the blood is still going to try to flow through and it can't do it. So it takes roundabout way to lead and blood vessels that represent an alternate pathway will become very dilated. It's kind of like if you're coming back from the mall and there's an accident there in front of the fire station where people are supposed to get together and two lanes become one. And everything's all backed up. Well, you know perfectly well what you're going to do if you're waiting in line. You're going to take the side streets, and all of a sudden they're congested with the cars trying to avoid the collision site. Well, that's the same thing here. The blood cannot get back through the liver, and so you're going to take all the side streets. At least much of it can't get back. So that leads to the pressure, leads to the dilated blood vessels, and can lead to very serious hemorrhage if those blood vessels pop. The spleen gets quite large. Again, it's in the system, and it's purely a function of backed up pressure, blood pressure. And then there are a whole host of problems that come about because of a huge spleen. The caput medusa is the head of the medusa, and remember, medusa has a snake head, and around their umbilicus you will see all kinds of dilated blood vessels that represent the alternate pathway that the blood is trying to take to get going. Now, cirrhosis of the liver can have several several gross appearances, but microscopic appearance is pretty common to all of them. And so some of the common features that we would see, again, cirrhosis just reflects chronic, ongoing injury that leads to scarring and botched up regeneration of the liver. Again, just to emphasize, it's irreversible. So this right here is what I went through before, and those are the symptoms. Well, this is showing the scarred up liver and nodules of regenerating liver, but they can't get the job done because they're not organized in lobules. This would be a kind of gross so-called macronodular. This is micronodular. This kind of pattern we tend to associate with post-hepatitis virus. This we associate, this micronodular one we associate with toxic injury like alcohol. This is showing the scar tissue in between, and although that scar tissue is rich in blood vessels, the blood that comes through the liver, what little bit can get through the liver, tends to follow these blood vessels and actually does not percolate through the liver cells or past the liver cells. It's basically coming through and going straight into the vena cava and never having gone past the liver cells, so it does not get detoxified. This is showing the ascites. This person has chronic hepatitis B, and you can see this greatly dilated abdomen with fluid, and this is the caput medusa. His umbilicus is down here, and you can see all these dilated blood vessels. So again, cirrhosis, irreversible scarring, botched regeneration because the underlying architecture is messed up. The backed up blood then in the venous system plays hell with fluid accumulation and dilated blood vessels. Because you don't have the intimate association with the liver cell that the blood should have it, it cannot discharge the albumin into the bloodstream, so they have low albumin, portal hypertension, all these things add up to this fluid, bleeding problems, and so on. There are many reasons to develop chronic ongoing liver scarring and liver injury. There are inherited conditions such as alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency and problems with iron metabolism, so-called pigmentary cirrhosis. Post-necrotic refers to major episode of hepatitis with a virus or ongoing chronic viral hepatitis. And when we say nutritional, it can mean one of two things. One, it can mean nutrition of an odd form, which is to say a lot of alcohol in your diet, or it can mean malnutrition. And people who are very seriously protein malnourished will also develop cirrhosis because they cannot maintain, they don't have enough amino acids in their diet, enough protein and amino acids then, for them to be able to continually make the structural proteins that they have to. And in that case, there's a breakdown of the collagen as they grow or as they remodel the liver, and the end result is something quite similar in terms of micronodular cirrhosis, where you cannot maintain or keep building that underlying architecture. So when the liver cells replicate, and they don't last forever, they have to be replaced now and again, the normal arrangement and growth is not there. Now, we're going to take a look now at a kind of high power view of what's going on. One of the first changes that we see in cirrhosis, and again, irrespective of the nature of it, the reason it happens. I'll probably be talking about infection and alcohol, but any of those conditions will lead to, the pattern is basically the same. It's just a matter of what starts it off. Okay, this is kind of a high power view. Here are two hepatocytes right here. This little star-shaped guy here is a bile duct. Out here, we have the endothelial cells line of the sinusoids. Here's the blood out here. Here's one of those fixed macrophages I talked about, a Kupffer cell. And here's the space of Desaix. Now, normally the space of Desaix is quite open. That's what we've seen in every other picture. It's open so that plasma can come out through these cells, out through these endothelial cells, and wash across these liver cells. And there, albumin is transporting and discharging its bilirubin there. It's getting picked up. The liver cell is putting clotting proteins into the bloodstream and so forth by this mechanism. Now, in that space of Desaix lives a special little cell called a stellate cell. And the stellate cell is our source of where we store our vitamin A. Well, say that lives there, but if under the influence of inflammatory mediators, interleukins that we see with chronic inflammation, this cell will transform into a fibroblast. You don't want that, but that's what happens. And so that cell right here, this stellate cell, transforms into a fibroblast and begins to produce collagen in that space of Desaix. Well, good heavens, that space of Desaix is supposed to stay open. Here we see a lymphocyte out here, and he's out there because there's inflammation, let's say. Now you start to scar away. You produce and elaborate and lay down collagen here in the space of Desaix because of the chronic inflammation, say of chronic hepatitis, or chronic alcohol injury, and now you're really seriously screwed because this is really important space. Well, you start losing that. This guy continues producing collagen. These cells start dying out here because of either hepatitis or alcohol abuse, and they're dying. We're scarring this away, the scar tissue. Eventually, there's destruction of the underlying architecture. Regeneration attempts itself, but it cannot get the job done because the underlying architecture of the lobule, that connective tissue framework that says liver cell, you belong here, vascular cell, you belong over here, and ductwork, you belong over here, all that now is gone. So So this right here is kind of the starting point for all forms of, really most forms of hepatitis, or most forms of cirrhosis. Okay, so the sequence of events is basically this: liver cell injury. Now, most times when our liver cells get injured, they die or they regenerate or something, and none of this happens. So cirrhosis is an end-stage product that some people end up at, but not everybody. But let's suppose here's what's going to happen if that is the case. So there's initially liver cell injury. There's chronic inflammation then that ensues. There's scarring and fibrosis. There's destruction of the underlying architecture. Attempts at regeneration are botched because the underlying architecture is missing. Again, it's progressive. It's irreversible. It's going to lead to basically a really scarred up, non-functioning liver. Once again, this is a diagrammatic showing gynecomastia. Again, the problem of the vessels, the blood vessels, trying to return blood from the GI tract through the liver, can't do it because of the scar tissue and loss of vessels, leads to dilated blood vessels as everything backs up behind it. Again, all of this blood here in this venous system is just like being backed up behind a car accident. You can't get through the liver, can't get past the car accident, so you start taking all the side streets. Unfortunately, what that means is the blood vessels here dilate, the spleen gets very large with problems related to that. here's something that we can see that we don't see often here, because this parasite doesn't live here, although we do occasionally encounter it in students or family members who come especially from the Middle East, particularly Egypt. I will just point this out because we've been talking about cirrhosis and scarring of the liver due to alcohol and viral hepatitis and so forth. That's not the only way in which it'll happen. Now, here's a parasite, schistosomiasis, which can lead to scarring of the liver. Again, we see this in Central Africa and in the Nile River Valley. You might say, oh boy, that's real interesting. That's a long ways away. But here in Bloomington, I've seen it several times in people who are here as grad students or family members from that area. So of all things, and also another one called Clonorchis sinensis, which is the Asian liver fluke, leading to scarring of the liver. So occasionally, we will see scar tissue and scarring, chronic inflammation in the liver, leading to a similar kind of process on the basis of parasites. I'm not, clearly that's not something that's native to this area, but okay, that sets the stage. Now we're going to be looking at specific kinds of injury now, inflammation, and many things that will lead to cirrhosis, but I just wanted to have some background as to what we mean by, when we talk about chronic liver injury leading to cirrhosis, that it is not just the fact that Uncle Bud sits around there with a beer in his hand all day long. I'm reminded of the situation, you know, where they say, if you give a man a fish, he eats for today. And if you teach him how to fish, he'll sit around in a boat all day drinking beer. Okay, it's not that situation. I mean, it's that, but it's also many other things that lead to that chronic inflammation. Okay, so let's talk about inflammatory conditions then of the liver, and there are lots of things that lead to it. When we think about inflammation and we see rubordol or kalor, say, of an infection on our skin, a zit or something, the first thing that comes to mind is bacteria. Well, bacteria can infect the liver, but there are lots of things that will trigger the inflammatory reaction within the liver. it's relatively common. So toxins and drugs, again, alcohol, but toxins that come in the GI tract, we can have direct bacterial involvement of the liver, absolutely, up into the bile ducts, into the gallbladder, or into the liver itself. Viruses can directly infect the liver cells. Epstein-Barr virus. If anybody's had mononucleosis, they know perfectly well how tired they are and how long it takes to recover, and that's because of the liver infection that you have at the same time. Cytomegalic inclusion virus, and obviously hepatitis-specific viruses, hepatitis A, hepatitis B, all those, and we're going to spend a good bit of time looking at those. I just mentioned the parasites and autoimmune. There are people who develop antibodies and have both T and B cell activation against constituents of your liver. It's just a matter of loss of, I would say, self-recognition in some people. It doesn't happen very often. occurs more frequently in women than men, and there might be some inflammatory trigger, some infectious trigger that starts it, but we definitely see autoimmune destruction of the liver, just like many others. Well, let's move to viral hepatitis, and here we are going to be looking essentially at these hepatic-specific viruses, I would say excluding yellow fever. We're going to look at hepatitis A and B, which I hope everybody listening to this is immunized against. It's one of those things that you can prevent, and you want to be immunized against it because, believe me, it will make you, it can kill you, the B can. A will make you sick enough that you think you have to die to get better. So when we think about viral hepatitis, there are a number of things that are really specific viruses to the liver cells. We're going to be looking at hepatitis A and B and C and E and whatnot. Well, first of all, in the acute phase of the injury, as you can imagine, people get sick. We will have dead liver cells, which are referred to as Councilman bodies. These are basically apoptotic liver cells. It's diffuse liver. It involves the whole liver. It's not generally focalized. Bacterial infections might be localized wherever the bacteria is, but in this case, every liver cell is subject to infection and often is infected. We might see the beginning infection, the beginning inflammation, right around the triads. Again, chronic inflammation means persistence, and in this case, it means more than 6 months. The duration of the infection, you just cannot get over it. And it leads to piecemeal necrosis, larger areas of necrosis within the lobule, 5 or 6 cells here and there, 20 cells here over there. It leads to what's called bridging necrosis. We'll take a look at that, and that is bridging cell death and fibrosis between triads and central veins. And that is the beginning point when that happens. That is the beginning point that we would call cirrhosis. Now, we're going to take a look here at something you have to kind of get your bearings on this to look at difference between acute and chronic hepatitis. We're only looking at a small section of the liver lobule. So if we had this right here was a whole liver lobule, we'll go all the way down off the screen on both sides, and we'd have a triad over here, a triad over there, and so on. We'll just look, here's one triad, here's a central vein, and here's a stripe of cells in between. So you have to imagine to fill in all the rest of the lobule around it. In acute hepatitis, most of the chronic inflammation, and it is, it's lymphocytes because it's a virus. And those are the guys who are fighting the virus. A good part of that is in the triads. And we will see individual dead liver cells. Now this would be with acute hepatitis A or hepatitis B, hepatitis C in the acute phase, cytomegalic inclusion, Epstein-Barr, a lot of different things. That's the acute phase. And believe it or not, for hepatitis A, B, for Epstein-Barr, almost everybody gets over it just fine right there. And there's no underlying architecture destruction. When the liver cells regenerate, everything comes back just like it's supposed to. Well, sometimes, however, it goes on to chronic hepatitis. And this would be the hallmark of hepatitis C and a small percentage of people with hepatitis B, but not A. And chronic hepatitis means we are going to see this bridging scarring and bridging and necrosis. You see, here's a triad. Here's a central vein. So you got to fill in the gap with liver cells mentally. But now we start to see bridging fibrosis. There's been complete destruction of the liver cells here. And now all you have is scar tissue left in that area. And as that process proceeds, eventually that becomes the majority of the liver, the scarring. Here we'll see piecemeal necrosis, and that is chunks of liver, dead liver cells, maybe 6 or 8 in a group. So that's indicative of chronic hepatitis. Now in terms of acute hepatitis, you can see that there are a lot of blue dots in here. Hope you can. Those are the lymphocytes. Here are these liver cells that are infected. They have kind of a ground glass looking cytoplasm. That's a dead cell there. But you can see this kind of ground glass looking cytoplasm. That's all the viral protein that's being made. And you'll see that virtually every liver cell is infected. Here are lymphocytes in there. Believe it or not, they will get a handle on it. You will make antibodies and you'll defeat the virus and get over it. So here's a dead liver cell. This might represent a councilman body, one of these apoptotic cells. In the case of chronic or persistent hepatitis, we see lots of lymphocytes. And here you can see this stripe of blue cells. Those are lymphocytes bridging out to the neighboring hepatic triad. And that is the hallmark of chronic hepatitis, ultimately leading to scarring and fibrosis and loss of liver architecture, and then crappy regeneration. We're going to take a look at specifics here of hepatitis A. Again, this is what you can be immunized against. You don't want this. This is one that does not have a chronic phase. You get it and you get over it, but you're really sick during that phase of it. This is not passed on by blood. This isn't comes from food. Shellfish, people pass the organism in the stool, and it gets on their hands, and then it gets mixed into the food. So this is an oral fecal-oral route of transmission. And this is often referred to as infectious hepatitis because it is highly infectious, and it'll go through a whole football team if the food handlers have it. So it can involve a lot of people. So the virus is being passed in the stool. We will see antibodies develop fairly quickly. You'll see here there's a latent period of about 2 weeks, maybe up to several months. And then all of a sudden the person starts to get sick and they got what they think is the worst flu of their life. They may become overtly jaundiced. At this point, we will see the viruses in the stool, and that's how it's being passed. That's the strategy it uses to get from person to person then. And once we develop the antibodies to it, that's the end of it, and you get over it. But it can take up to 6 months before you actually recover your full strength. And if you can flush 6 months of your life down the drain, let's suppose this happens like it did to a friend of mine who was a doctor here in town, and he came down with it when he was on a trip in the Caribbean. He ate some raw shellfish or something and got it that way. Now, he was out of the office for almost 6 full months, and his partners were ready to kill him. You know, they're doubled up on call. You'll be in exactly the same situation. You'll have a group. You'll be in a practice someplace, more than likely. And if you can get your partners to say, hey, listen, just take 6 months off and hell with it, you know, good luck. So you want to get immunized against this sucker. It's easy to do. Doesn't last all your life. You do have to have some booster shots now and again. But we look for the IgM, as you can imagine, arising early, and then the IgG. IgM disappears, and IgG may last your life. We don't generally look for the virus because it drops off so quickly, and we don't like handling the stool because it's handling the stool, for one thing, but it's so highly infective. So we don't actually look for the virus itself. Now, that's different in the case of hepatitis B. So you want to know about hepatitis A. It's basically short-lived. There is no chronic carrier status. It's not going to lead to cirrhosis, but it is going to make you sick as all hell for a while. Now, hepatitis B is so-called serum hepatitis. This is transmitted by blood, but actually most of it is transmitted sexually. This is a sexually transmitted disease, and in clinics where we deal with people who come in with gonorrhea or something else, we are always testing for hepatitis B. The overwhelming majority of hepatitis B is sexually transmitted. I just consider it a sexually transmitted disease, just like chlamydia or, you know, potentially herpes or HIV or something like that. But it can be transmitted by blood products, and so it's known as serum hepatitis, and that's how it got its name. But it's bloodborne. It has much longer incubation period as a rule. It's extremely common among people in Asia right now. In fact, the leading cause of death, cancer death of people in China is hepatocellular carcinoma, the liver cancer, because of this. Now, most people get over it just fine, but some people will go on to the chronic phase and have cirrhosis and so on if it's not. And there are some things, tricks we can use to try and get a person to mount the antibodies they need, but it doesn't always work. Okay, this composite here again is showing us what's going on. We have this latency period following exposure, and we're going to say this writer's unprotected sex right here with someone who is a carrier of it. You contract it, and then you have up to 6 months. And now we see a rise in the virus, and that's what this red line represents, would be the viral antigens or the virus itself, but it's in the bloodstream. That's where we see it, and that's what we measure. And here we do look for the presence of the virus, the surface protein. We will look for the viral DNA. We actually can PCR the DNA. We can look for unique enzymes that we find in the virus that will be present in the bloodstream, and that helps determine whether a person is actually getting over it as they should. So they're going to be very symptomatic. Again, they think they got a really bad flu. Some of them, in fact, majority of people actually don't become jaundiced. Some people do. You might think, well, wait a minute, I thought you said the liver was sick. That's true, it is. But most people, in fact, are able for the liver to recover sufficiently such that they don't become overtly jaundiced or yellow. And then we start making the antibodies, and we look for antibodies to the core, which is the inside part of the virus, and also to the DNA replicase that it makes, the hepatitis E antigen. And those antibodies appear quickly and drop off. And what we want to see develop is this hepatitis, an antibody, an IgG antibody to the surface protein. Now, you can make it to the core protein, but it's the only thing that actually confers lifelong immunity is antibody to the surface protein. So we refer to this as the anti-HB surface antigen. We're making it against the antigen. It's our antibody. So we're looking for an antibody against that surface protein. And if you're one of the 5% of people who come down with it that don't do this, you could be a chronic carrier. So some people simply don't. And that also means that some people who don't respond to the vaccine for the same reason. And why that is, I don't know. You simply don't view that surface protein as being being non-self. That's what it amounts to. Well, most people get over it just fine, but this right here can stimulate immunologic injury because your liver cells that are infected express virus proteins on the surface, so the T cells come in and destroy them. And if you can't successfully get rid of the virus, your T cells are always going to be destroying your liver cells. Less commonly, it can proceed to chronic injury and cirrhosis. On very rare occasions, somebody will have an extraordinarily bad reaction or extraordinary susceptibility to it, and their whole liver dies all at once in that very first infection. Fulminant means overwhelming, and so it's overwhelming failure and death right there with the very first infection. Cirrhosis, and then a chronic carrier status where a person, interestingly enough, is not really sick with anything and their liver isn't sick. It's just that a few liver cells are busy making viruses and you never react to it. You're not sick, but you're spreading it. The person who has chronic hepatitis and cirrhosis is also spreading it, but this person is actually not sick with anything and their liver is not being destroyed. That's an uncommon event, but it can happen. So this is looking at what is the chronic status. And again, this is not typical. Most people get over it just fine. This is probably less than 10% of people, probably less than 5% even, who will go on to develop chronic infection and chronic ongoing scarring. So you can have two kinds of chronic carrier status. One, who's not sick or doing anything to their liver, and they simply don't see the virus as being abnormal at all, and a person who does see it as being an abnormal but can't get rid of it. And the end result here is you will see that they do not make these IgG antibodies. And so they are chronically sick with it. There's chronic destruction and ongoing fibrosis leading to cirrhosis. You know, 10, 15 years down the road, their liver's completely shot. Whereas this other person who is, for whatever reason, just doesn't see it as abnormal, is never really sick with it, but they are a chronic carrier. This is showing what happens. Most of the people, 90% of the people, are up here in this category right here. Here's acute infection, and lo and behold, something like 85% of the people simply are sick with it and get over it fine, and nothing happens. Very small percentage of people will die in that acute phase with fulminant hepatitis. Here's this healthier carrier guy, and he truly is healthy. They don't make antibodies, they don't care, their liver doesn't get sick, nothing happens. you know? Crazy. Other people, about 5% or so, will go off to this persistent infection, and they are the ones who may develop cirrhosis over a period of several years. So that's hepatitis B, completely different than hepatitis A. Hepatitis C is in the news all the time now. Hepatitis C is the one that we see chronic carrier status coming out many times, at least chronic infections, I should say, many times. I hesitate to even say what percentage goes on to that, because you can have prolonged periods where there is very little viral production, very little viral growth, and the consequence is that it'll look like somebody has now defeated the virus. They're in this stage, they did this over here, made all the antibodies and killed it, and yet it might be weeks or months before it actually reactivates. So we can see this kind of situation in many people. Hepatitis C, there are about six different types of the subsets of the virus. They're working on a number of things that will interfere with viral replication that will help a person get over it. But if you're in this category here, you can pretty well put your money down. You're going to have cirrhosis and a dead liver after, say, 10 years or so. So hepatitis C, it's a virus. Again, it's a hepatic-specific virus. I would say 50% or so of the people are here, but you never know who that is. That the virus appears, you make all the antibodies, you get over it. Because you can have these prolonged periods where people seem to be okay, and then it comes back. Hepatitis C is increasing. In fact, in my age group, it's recommended that everybody over the age of 60 is tested for hepatitis C. So it's a very high rate of persistence. Unlike the other two, it's a very long incubation period. It comes back, and in many people leads to cirrhosis and death from that. Here is a virus. It's actually a fractured or fragmented virus called the Delta agent. We went from A, B, C. Now D is the this Delta agent. It's incapable actually of replicating on its own in a liver cell. However, it needs, it's like a co-virus. And if you're already infected with hepatitis B or it comes at that time, then it can replicate because it requires enzymes that are present in the hepatitis B virus. So you can't really get infected with a Delta agent of the hepatitis or D by itself. It has to be two together. And then that really does lead to serious problems. Now, again, that's just another reason to be immunized against hepatitis B, because if you can't get sick with hepatitis B, then whether you get exposed to the Delta agent is immaterial, because the Delta agent cannot reproduce on its own in your liver cell in the absence of hepatitis B. So hepatitis, and again, we're referring to, again, hepatitis is a general term, meaning inflammation only of the liver, but we kind of use it, I'm using it in this sense to refer to hepatitis-specific viruses. It can be asymptomatic, and in fact, a lot of them are, or it can just be very bad flu-like symptoms. They may have overt jaundice, and this all depends on how quickly your immune system nails the virus. Some people get to it in a hurry and get it over with. Some don't. So you may be overtly jaundiced, but you're still going to get over it. So some people may move off into a carrier state. Again, there are just a few viruses that will do that. Hepatitis A is not one. There may be fulminant liver failure at the outset, or it may lead to a chronic situation, ultimately end-stage scarring and cirrhosis of the liver. I talk about autoimmune hepatitis, and then we will, let's see where I am here in my notes for this. This is a good place to stop. I think we've done enough for one unit. So we'll pick it up with autoimmune hepatitis in the second lecture then.